You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a stack of 100-year-old mahogany boards recently made the trip from a Wisconsin lab to the U.S. Capitol to repair damage done in the riot on January 6th. We'll hear what makes the wood so special and why Washington came calling. Now, three hearings down, one to go. The legislature's Joint Finance Committee is getting public input on Governor Evers' proposed state budget and their own budget plans. The governor's $91 billion plan would be a nearly 10% increase over the current two-year budget. It includes a $1.6 billion boost for K-12 schools, a $192 million increase for the UW system. It also aims to spend more than $94 million to modernize the state's unemployment insurance system and hire more staff. Republican leaders in the legislature have said they'll start from scratch with their own budget plan. Public hearings have been held this month in Whitewater, Rhinelander, and Menominee. There's also a virtual hearing this week. Then the Joint Finance Committee will take up individual pieces of the plan. You can join in on the conversation at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts? What are your priorities for Wisconsin's budget for the next couple of years? What do you want lawmakers to know before they get to work on the plan? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll hear today from two state lawmakers, including Democratic Senator LaTanya Johnson from Milwaukee. Now, Joan Balwag is a Republican state senator from Marquesan and a member of the Joint Finance Committee. Senator Balwag, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be with you and your listeners, Rob.
Well, you've had three of these hearings, Senator Balwag, a lot of testimony. What kind of things are you hearing from the public at these hearings?
Well, most of the folks are coming in support of different particular aspects of the governor's budget. There have been a few that are advising against some things, but we've heard, depending on where you were on a particular campus, we heard things about that particular campus's ask. We've heard support for K-12 funding. We've heard support from our long-term care community in trying to get them some increases to what is currently MA funding for them. They've been working really hard through this period of COVID with their very vulnerable population, and they lose money on each of those patients that are with them for MA. So that's been something that's been at every topic at every hearing.
There have been calls for some more hearings. The speaker schedule has filled up pretty quickly on all of them so far. The Joint Finance co-chairs say they're going to stick with the current plan. Would you support having more hearings, or is four enough and people can comment in different ways?
Well, people can comment. They can contact their legislator directly. They can contact the members of Joint Finance. And there is a Joint Finance Committee email that people can contact also with their information. But we did run out of folks at the three public hearings. The UW-Whitewater one, we ran out of people at 4. Up at Rhinelander, we ran out of people at 3:30. And at UW-Stout and Menominee, we ran out of folks to testify at 4:30. Now, I know the virtual slots filled up pretty quickly, but I think that we're hearing some pretty common themes, and so individual folks can contact us directly.
We've got this budget proposal from Governor Evers. Leaders in your party in the legislature say they're going to kind of build their own plan instead of starting from there. Do you see areas of common ground that you think Republicans in the legislature could look at the governor's plan and come up with something that they all agree on?
I think that is very likely. If you take a look at several of the bills that we passed in the legislature 2 weeks ago on how to spend some of the federal funding that's coming forward, it was an attempt to say there's some things in the budget that we all agree on, so let's target some of this federal funding so that we can reserve our general purpose revenue and our tax dollars to the ongoing needs that we have in Wisconsin. So it was disappointing that the governor didn't take us up on those proposals, but we're going to continue from the legislative side to budget responsibly. We have a surplus here in Wisconsin right now, even though Many states around us are suffering after the pandemic. And I think that, you know, the governor's proposal to raise taxes, even with doing some of the Medicaid expansion and taxing recreational marijuana, are still things that are still beyond what we're going to be comfortable with.
Talking to State Senator Joan Bollweg, Republican from Marquesan, member of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee, about big budget priorities for the next 2 years here in Wisconsin. At Senator Bollweg, you chair the Senate Agriculture and Tourism Committee. What do you see as some top priorities for the state budget in those areas?
Well, I think those are some things that we will be able to agree on. Everyone realizes that last term we had a speaker's task force on water quality. Last term, the governor did say it was the year of drinking water and water quality. So there are individual proposals that he's put in his budget that were actually some of those bills. So I certainly think that we're going to be able to come together on those, addressing some of the non-point issues. The producer-led watershed ideas is something that we really need to take a look at. The well compensation grants, and of course, continuing to do what we can to combat some of the lead issues that we've seen in our water. Now, a couple of things on more the agricultural side is a bill that Representative Kurtz and I introduced. It was something that he introduced last term, and the governor has a similar type of proposal in the governor, and this would be an ag export initiative. The difference is that we've put into our bill is to make sure that all of agriculture is covered for exports. If you take a look at Wisconsin, where one of every nine folks are dependent or connected to the ag economy for their jobs, and we're in the top 10 in the United States for states in producing ag and ag receipts, but we are in the next tier when it comes to ag exports. So the $5 million that we're proposing over the next couple of years is something that I think will help us connect and really expand those markets. And the other thing I wanted to mention that was something that everyone knows, we had quite a disruption to our the supply chain when it came to meat during the pandemic. And the governor has a proposal to enhance meat processing in Wisconsin. I think, and I've heard from local folks that people who are visiting Wisconsin, people who are who live in Wisconsin, they're looking to get their meat from their local processors. And so this proposal that the governor has that I think we'll try to get done has to do with allowing for local processors to expand. Workforce is always a problem. So that is something that is in the governor's proposal, as well as having our good Wisconsin folks be the ones who are doing the meat inspection at those processors. So those are a couple of the ag issues that I know we're going to be taking a look at.
I want to touch on education for a bit, because for the governor's budget proposal, that's what drives a lot of the increased spending, both the K-12 schools and the university system as well. When you look at the scale of what the governor is calling for, do you see room for that? Do you see that as being affordable?
Well, Wisconsin does spend about 65% of all the funding to our K-12 schools. Of course, with our school funding formula, that doesn't exactly flow the way everyone would like. But as a former elementary teacher myself, I know what it's like to be in the classroom and, you know, value especially those earliest of years so kids are prepared. The saying is that you start out learning to read so you can learn by reading as you move forward. So, yes, I think we've done quite a job in supporting special education in last budget. We increased that by quite a bit. That was also something that we heard in the listening sessions around the state. And another thing that people have been talking to us is support for mental health of our children in our K-12 schools, and that was something that I worked on last term as the chairperson of the Speaker's Task Force on Suicide Prevention. So we did get a couple of those bills signed into law last year, but not all of them. So these are some of the same type of programs that the governor has in his budget. So we hope to enhance some of the one of our initiatives was for additional training for folks that would go into our schools to train the trainers so that they have a better handle on how to do this. At our meeting when the DPI was in front of us for the agency briefings, I was asking our current state superintendent, not the superintendent to be, questions about are we thinking forward, are we preparing our educators as to how they're going to handle for those students that were not in school, the related trauma from that. And also I've heard from people in my school districts, most of whom have been open full time, just to make sure that they are taking care of these students when they have questions and maybe are unsure about what's happening in the big wide world.
Senator Baldwin, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Happy to be with you.
Joan Baldwin is a Republican state senator from Marquesan, member of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. We'll get a Democratic take on the state budget in just a moment. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk now on the state budget. The Joint Finance Committee has been holding public hearings on Governor Evers' proposed two-year spending plan. There's a virtual hearing coming up on Wednesday. Republican leaders in the legislature say they'll build their own budget plan. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions about the budget. We just heard from Republican Senator Joan Baldwin. Now we get a Democratic perspective from LaTanya Johnson. She's a state senator from Milwaukee who also serves on the Joint Finance Committee. Senator Johnson, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, what are your overall thoughts so far on the state budget proposal and where it's going?
You know, my overall thoughts on the state budget is that Governor Evers has gotten it right. We see the emphasis on Wisconsinites, the people, small business. And I believe that reflects from what he's heard around the state, from what people want to see in the budget. You know, it's always a matter of what my Republican colleagues will allow to stay in the budget. But so far, I think he's hit the nail on the head with the things that people from Wisconsin want to see in their budget.
We just heard from Senator Baldwin about special education funding. The governor's proposal would boost about $713 million. That would mean the state's picking up about half eligible special ed costs for districts. That's up from 29% now. What is your reaction to that part of his proposal?
I think that that's excellent because special education in the state has been underfunded for so, so long. And we need to make sure that our kids with disabilities, that they're receiving the quality education that they deserve. And when there's not enough money in the budget for special education, the schools find themselves having to take that revenue from their general funds. I think the Department of Public Instruction indicated that the school district spent an estimated $270 million on pupil services. And, you know, that, and the state only reimbursed them for about $6 million of that. And so not only does investing in special education helps those kids with disability receive a quality education, but it also gives the school the flexibility that they need to address the needs of the general student population. And that's just as important.
One concern from Republicans about the governor's budget is even if these are worthy things he wants to spend money on, it's a big increase. And it requires a lot of revenue in the form of getting rid of some tax exemptions that are on the books, would require, well, it includes recreational marijuana, which Republicans say they aren't going for. What would you say about just the cost, the price tag of what the governor has put forth here?
You know, the cost is substantial, but so is investing in Wisconsinites. We've just came through a year of COVID where everyone is hurting, and particularly our kids and their school systems are hurting. Everyone is trying to find extra revenue to make ends meet. So we can't continue to leave money on the table and not, you know, service the people of the state in the ways that they need services, and the quality services cost. And the fact that it's a pandemic, we're going to have to invest not only in the needs that our residents had prior to COVID, but also in the needs that they have after COVID. And that's going to cost substantially.
We're talking about Wisconsin's state budget. A new one is in the works. Senator LaTanya Johnson is with us, state senator from Milwaukee, who serves on the Joint Finance Committee. I know you have your eye also on funding for the UW system in a few different ways. The Evers budget would include an expansion of the program called Bucky's Tuition Promise, including free tuition for some low-income state residents. Why do you have your eye on that specific part of the budget?
That is one of the most my favorite parts of the budget, because it is a game changer for Wisconsin. It will allow so many more students from economically disadvantaged families to go to college. It provides free tuition for any UW school for kids whose parents earn under $60,000. Now, that's going to be after all qualified financial aid is received, but that's huge. For so many kids in the state, the families just can't afford to pay that parental contribution. And for so many kids, you know, college is just unobtainable because they have to work and their parents can't afford to help out. And so this would be a game changer in allowing those students to be self-sufficient and to enroll in these universities and to get that quality education. Because even students who do enroll, because the parents can't afford to help out, some of them find themselves having to drop out because the cost is just too high. And we want to give everyone in this state an opportunity to receive a higher education and contribute to the state. We have so many needs in terms of social workers and nurses and individuals in the health field and even teachers, and especially for those individuals to be people of color. So this would be a game changer for Wisconsin.
We had a question from a listener, Terry in Racine, wondering and looking for insight on why the Medicaid expansion plan continues to get turned down in Wisconsin. Long-running debate when the Affordable Care Act passed, Wisconsin didn't take extra federal money. I believe Governor Evers' budget calls for taking it. Republicans in the legislature say, nope, still no. What's your read on that?
You know, I agree. I'm wondering the same thing, because it makes no economical sense that we would continue to not expand Medicaid. Not only could we save taxpayers $650 million, but on top of that, we would be eligible for an additional $1 billion, making that $1.6 billion that we're missing out on. When Republicans say that we can't afford certain things in this budget, and particularly the cost, I don't understand that conversation, because we're leaving $1.6 billion on the table. COVID hit communities of color exceptionally hard. And the reason that community of colors suffered from COVID so much worse than our white counterparts is because a lot of us already had pre-existing conditions. In so many of our impoverished neighborhoods, just like rural areas, you don't have access to doctors, especially those in underprivileged, disadvantaged communities. So this would not only allow us to expand the coverage by 38%, but it would give us extra incentive dollars for accepting it. And so there's no logical explanation that you can provide in saying that we can't afford anything in this budget when we are leaving $1.6 billion on the table.
In just our last few moments, Senator Johnson, do you have thoughts to share with your Republican colleagues on ways to work together?
You know what? In this building, in this atmosphere, if I had that advice, I would probably be, you know, a Pulitzer Prize winner or something. But we have to find a way to work together. And we have to be respectful and accepting of each other's ideas. To just say that, you know, certain parts of the budget is just going to be flat out rejected when my Republican colleagues have sat in the same listening sessions that I have, and Medicaid expansion, special education, education period for our kids come up over and over and over. It's really easy in these positions to not remember that we sit in seats of privilege, but those seats should extend to empathy and sympathy for other people around the state that do not have the same opportunities that we do. And if there are people in our state that are suffering, it's our job to try and remedy that. This state has been ranked the worst place in the nation for African American children. So you know what that is for their parents as well. We can't continue to just kick these problems down the road and expect them to remedy themselves. It's going to take work. It's going to take legislation, and it's going to take cooperation. And so far, that's been the most difficult thing to accomplish.
Senator Johnson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
LaTanya Johnson is a Democratic state senator from Milwaukee. We heard from Republican Senator Joan Volwig, both on the Joint Finance Committee. Find out how to comment at WPR.org Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Wisconsin Attorney General's Office will investigate long-running cases of abuse in the state's Catholic churches. We'll find out what led to the decision for the state to get involved. Now, about 3,000 pounds of rare mahogany recently made its way from Madison's Forest Products Laboratory to the U.S. Capitol building. After the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol, the group that maintains the building and grounds found damage to some of the doors and woodwork. In need of the right material for the repairs, they ended up getting in touch with our next guest. Robert Ross is acting assistant director at the USDA Forest Products Lab in Madison. He's a research professor at Michigan Tech University and the author of hundreds of articles on wood evaluation. Bob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure to be on.
Can you tell us the origin story, how these mahogany boards came to be stored at the lab for quite a long time?
Yeah, these boards were part of a study, from what we can tell, that dates to about 1918 that the Forest Products Lab did in conjunction with the War Department in support of the development of propellers for wooden aircraft used over in France.
And now, this is something they could work with then. Now it's virtually impossible to get this kind of wood, right?
Yeah, it really is. The sizes, just to give you an idea, we had about 80 boards that we shipped. Some of them were all full 2 foot wide, 16 foot long, inch thick, with not a defect in them. Just beautiful wood.
How did the connection with the U.S. Capitol come about?
Well, we've been doing some work with the Defense Department on some other projects, and one of my colleagues saw the insurrection, as I did, and a bunch of us did, and knew of what we had at our laboratory. He'd been to visit us several times, and he just called me up, and he said, Bob, you think you can help out with the restoration work that's probably going to be going on at the Capitol, and provide some technical expertise as well as any materials you might have? And I said, you bet, absolutely. So it started from that phone call. He put us in contact with the folks at U.S. Capitol, the organization that has responsibility for that. It's called the Architect of the Capitol. And we just started working via the phone and internet and eventually transferred the material.
How does one transfer hundreds of pounds of mahogany wood, given that you don't want to scuff it at all, I imagine, on the way?
Well, we took out every piece, and we weighed it, got all the dimensions. It had been in our storage sheds down in our basement of our laboratory for you know, many, many decades. And we double-wrapped it, triple-wrapped it, and then put it on a flatbed. And, you know, then it was tarped when it was on the flatbed, and then we shipped it directly to the Capitol.
I understand this is not the first historic monument, in this case the Capitol, that you have worked on or consulted on, including a Civil War battleship? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. As a national lab, we get pulled into a lot of these issues when they come up, and they call us because we're the National Wood Utilization Laboratory. And so, yeah, one that I was involved with back in the 1990s. Yeah, it's a little early.
Not quite that old, yeah.
Not quite, no. But was Old Ironsides, USS Constitution. A little history on that. It's the oldest commissioned ship in the U.S. Navy. It's entirely made of wood. The hull is made of a species of wood that grows in the southeastern part of the United States called live oak. And the reason it's named Old Ironside is when they shot cannonballs at them, it bounced right off. That species of wood is very, very strong, very tough, very resilient. And ironically, that ship, all that material in the hull is still original material. So that ship was about 200 years old in the 1990s. What we got called in to do was help when they were preparing it for the anniversary, the 200th anniversary of its launch. And so we used some of our ultrasound scanning techniques and went through the ship and looked for areas in need of repair or replacement. We could isolate those, repair them, and be ready to go.
And what's it like for you to see your work ending up on a historical artifact or monument, whether that's a battleship or a U.S. Capitol, knowing you've done something that's going to affect these things in the long haul?
It's an incredible feeling, Rob. It really is. It's so humbling to even be asked. And then to look at them and see what you did, and you think, man, I'm just a working-class kid from Michigan, you know, who's just got a great opportunity to work in an incredible place. But it's just very humbling. It's just humbling. I don't know what else to say. Now, the Capitol is really important to me because, you know, that there's a reason why it's called the Capitol. That's the center of our democracy. You know, that's the people's house. So to be able to work on that is just an incredible feeling. It really is.
And I hope you could paint a picture for us, because I'm picturing, oh, we had this mahogany sitting around, and I'm picturing, you know, my basement pre-cleaning. Do you just have this, like, huge warehouse full of woods? How does one archive this kind of collection?
Well,
what does it look like?
Well, I'll tell you what. Down in our carpenter shop in part of our facility, which is a big – the Forest Products Lab is not your standard little old one-room laboratory. It's a big complex, and we do have – storage areas that we keep our extra raw material. Say a study gets completed and we haven't used all the specimens, and we'll store it in there and reuse it. This particular case, it was labeled, and so we knew it. To verify it, I went to our library, which is the biggest wood library in the world, and I talked to our librarian and I said, hey, do you have the original reports on these studies? Sure enough, I've got reports that date back to 1918 up through about 1920 on the studies that were designed to look at using mahogany, laminated mahogany, and wooden propellers for the War Department. They're all there. Scientifically, they're just solid as can be. And all the data's there in those beautiful reports. Now, give you a little historic perspective. They're typed on onion skin paper. A little bit brittle, so I got to be a little careful when I'm thumbing through them, but just an incredible series of reports, an incredible amount of science that was done, and it's all available. It was right there.
Just before we wrap up, Bob, I'm learning a lot here, and I just learned, if I heard you right, Wisconsin is the largest wood library in the world?
It has the largest physical library as far as information on wood. So old reports, documentation, that's the best library in the wood related to in the world related to wood.
Cool. Well, Bob, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, guys. Thanks for your time. I can't tell you how many times I've listened to your show, and I always enjoy it. So thank you so much.
Fantastic. Let's see if I can get a tour of that lab sometime. Bob Ross is the Acting Assistant Director at the USDA Forest Products Laboratory in Madison. Talked with us about how rare mahogany boards from the lab are being used to repair damage from the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol building. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an answer to a Wisconsin question about a county and its curious shape.
Dunn County in western Wisconsin once had access to the Mississippi River. Its early boundary held for a few years until its southernmost portion got swept up in politics and emerged as Pepin County. Liz Domes-Harder brings us the answer to a Wisconsin question about how Pepin County got its unique shape.
Take a look at a map of Wisconsin. It's 65,000 square miles, cut into 72 counties by relatively boxy borders. There are some exceptions. For one, Pepin County in western Wisconsin that shares a border with the Mississippi River.
The shape of this county looks like a square root symbol, and it's super tiny.
That's Joe Hackbarth. He's a physical education teacher at La Crosse Logan High School. As a fan of geography, he wanted to know how Pepin County got its shape.
I should probably say I have nothing against Pepin County, but I saw the map and it just struck me as, well, that's kind of curious. You know, why does it exist?
When Wisconsin became a state, there already were 28 counties. Here's Howard Varigan, the state's cartographer.
Pepin was part of what was then Chippewa County, which at that time was a much larger entity than Chippewa County is today.
Basically, a wide strip from the Mississippi River northeast to present-day Iron County. Large counties weren't ideal back in the day, especially when services were dispatched from the county seat. For Chippewa County, that was Chippewa Falls.
At Pepin, when we were part of Chippewa, it took 2 days to ride to Chippewa Falls.
That's Terry Mesh. Behind a face mask, he points to a framed map showing the county's former boundary. The map is hung in the hall of the Old Courthouse Museum in Durand, where Mesh is a volunteer manager and tour guide.
So the closer you were to the seat of justice, the sooner you would get service, etc. That's what drove the creation of smaller and smaller counties.
Some men fought hard for that. Men like William Boyd Newcomb, who platted the village of Pepin. In his fight, Newcomb helped carve a piece out of Chippewa County to establish Dunn County. Dunn County was divided into seven new townships. In the south were Pepin and Bear Creek.
William Boyd Newcomb merely asked for the severing, cutting off of these two townships and forming them into Pepin County.
Why? Because he felt slighted by the county he had a hand in establishing. In 1854, he was appointed Dunn County Register of Deeds to fill a vacant seat. Finding qualified applicants was often hard for fledgling counties, and Dunn County was no different.
Dunn County was having such a problem organizing that the state legislature stepped in and they set a new election for November of 1855, before the two-year cycle of a normal term.
Newcomb was effectively ousted from his Dunn County office.
His feelings got hurt bad enough for him to now begin the process of creating a whole new county.
Lots of folks were against the new county, including two assemblymen who demanded that their minority opinion be written into the assembly journal. That opinion piece is printed and framed in the museum. For theatrics, it's read aloud by Mesh.
The shape of the new county is such as necessarily, at first look, must strike everyone of the impropriety of the division. An eye upon the map will speak a loud language.
Not exactly loud enough. Pepin became a county on February 25th, 1858.
WPR's Liz Domes-Harder brought us that story on the curious shape of Pepin County. And that story idea came from an audience member as part of our Wisconsin project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll learn about an upcoming state investigation into the Catholic Church over accusations of long-running abuse. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. As a heads up to our listeners, our next conversation talks about sexual abuse within the Catholic Church and other sensitive topics. Wisconsin will investigate sexual abuse within Catholic dioceses and other religious organizations, according to a document from the State Attorney General's office. Attorney General Josh Call is expected to make an announcement on the matter tomorrow. The investigation comes after decades of allegations, and the state will look at the overall scope and timeline of abuse. Laura Salty is a government agencies and state government reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Laura, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me back.
Laura, the Attorney General announced it'll have a news conference tomorrow, it looks like, on this issue. What do we know about what they are working on?
Yeah, so we're expecting Josh Call to announce an investigation into abuse by clergy members in the five dioceses across the state. We know that some of these dioceses have already done internal investigations and released lists. The only one that hasn't so far is Superior. They're expected to release their list by the end of the year. So they'll be looking at the information those dioceses have already released, as well as other internal documents that might be there to be looked at.
And you had written about this before this announcement, about this upcoming announcement. What did you know going into this? How did you find out that the state was going to be doing this?
So I've been working with my colleague, Haley B. Miller, in Green Bay, and we've been looking at this issue for years. You know, survivors of these crimes who are now adults, who were abused as children, you know, have been pushing for something like this for years. They, in a lot of cases, they aren't able to pursue justice. These memories don't start coming back to them until later in their lives. And by that point, the statute of limitations has closed for even a civil lawsuit against, you know, the agency that, you know, hosted this abuser, or the abuser themselves. So this is going to be a great relief to a lot of people who are, you know, kind of suffering with the consequences of abuse.
And as you mentioned, there were internal investigations by the church, and there have been individual prosecutions of priests, including one of the most notorious, Thomas Erickson, found guilty. But what does it mean now that the state, the Attorney General's office, is going to be doing this outside, wider, not just individual investigation?
Yeah, it opens up an opportunity for a lot more survivors to pursue justice. In the case of Thomas Erickson, the survivors were able to pursue criminal, you know, charges against him because he had left the state, you know, soon after the abuse occurred. So the statute of limitations was paused and never restarted because he never came back to live in the state again. You know, in the cases of many other survivors, they don't have that option. The statute of limitations has run out. In other states that have opened these AG investigations, you know, some of these survivors have received settlements. They've seen, you know, the organization held accountable for hiding details about abuse and moving clergy members around from church to church after abuse occurred.
What have you heard from the Catholic organizations, the dioceses and others that you've talked to about how they would be cooperating with an attorney general investigation?
Yes, we haven't heard from the majority of dioceses. The Milwaukee Archdiocese said that they were interested in hearing what Josh Call had to say at the meeting that he held with them today at 2 p.m. In the Superior Diocese said something along the same lines. You know, in previous years, when I've talked with representatives of the Superior Diocese, they said that they would, you know, they would participate in an investigation and hand over information that was necessary to complete an investigation like this.
Talking to Laura Schulte with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about an investigation expected to be announced tomorrow by Attorney General Josh Call, looking into the Catholic Church and organizations around the state, looking for wider patterns related to sexual abuse within the church. Laura, you mentioned other states, and Massachusetts was one of the ones that really broke the ice on these kinds of investigations. Can you talk about the kind of things they found there when it came to how the church was handling these accusations and what they were doing in response?
Yeah, in a lot of the investigations, you know, call to mind Spotlight, that the very popular movie that came out a few years ago. The Catholic Church was moving abusers around. So, you know, a clergy member would be accused of abuse in one parish, you know, one community, and they would move them to another community, you know, saying that they moved them away from the temptation, or, you know, they had stopped doing it. But what we were seeing is that they continued to, you know, perpetrate this type of abuse across every, you know, every assignment that they had in every community.
You've been following this issue for quite a while, I know. Have we seen changes in the way that the church handles accusations of abuse in the present day as compared to how they used to?
I think in today's age, you know, as a society, we're much more willing to talk about sexual abuse. So, you know, in that way, things have gotten a little bit easier for survivors. But still, you know, in the cases with survivors that I've spoken with directly, they've still found it pretty hard, you know, to go to the diocese. They haven't gotten the answers that they asked for. They didn't get the resources that they asked for. They kind of just got kicked around from, you know, internal person to internal person without ever receiving an answer.
Talking to survivors now about this investigation coming from the Attorney General, what are their hopes? What are they hoping comes out of all this?
The survivors I've spoken to are really just hoping to see some form of justice. They want to see the organization, the Catholic Church, held accountable. They just want to see, you know, these organizations, these dioceses admit that wrong was done. You know, one thing that you hear time and time again is that these survivors are seeking money. And that's not true. These survivors, you know, were deeply hurt. They've had their relationship with religion damaged. They just want to know that the, you know, the people who are moving these clergy members from parish to parish and the organizations that supported that are being held accountable.
And you write, you and your colleagues write in your piece that a lot of the survivors you've talked to have been calling for Wisconsin's Attorney General and past Attorney Generals, I think, to do this kind of investigation. Do we have an idea why it's taken until 2021 for this to get started?
You know, we haven't gotten that answer. We are hoping to get that answer soon. We're hoping to hear more from Call tomorrow when he announces the investigation in the morning. We just don't know why it's taken so long. We've been asking about it for years, but you know, at this point, it seems like this investigation will be moving forward.
And we're getting this announcement from the Attorney General tomorrow. What are you going to be watching for as you continue to follow this story?
I think we'll be watching for, you know, what this investigation is going to include, if there is going to be any sort of legal action, any sort of settlement with the dioceses. But I think also we'll be watching for the stories of these survivors. I mean, I think it's very important to highlight, you know, their strength and their resilience and, you know, the fact that they are finally going to see the justice that they've been asking for.
We'll leave it there, Laura. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Laura Schulte is a government agencies and state government reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us today to talk about an investigation into clergy sex abuse in Catholic organizations around the state. As we heard, Attorney General Josh Call expected to make a formal announcement of that investigation tomorrow. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, a UW researcher shares advice on rebuilding our social lives after the pandemic. That's coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, Congress is debating the issue of qualified immunity, especially when it comes to police, during the consideration of a new police reform bill. We'll talk about what qualified immunity is, what it actually does, and how the debate around it may be changing in the United States. Remember, you can follow our conversations live or archived anytime online at WPR.org, or you can download the WPR app to your smartphone or other device. Find that app wherever you get all your apps, or again, follow us live streaming at WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.